This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Charlotte Gallagher, and at 14 hours GMT on Friday, the 24th of January, these are our main stories. We'll have the latest on the new coronavirus outbreak as parts of China remain under lockdown. In Iraq, tens of thousands of people marched to demand the removal of US troops. There are fears about huge swarms of locusts in East Africa, which are destroying crops. Also in this podcast, why the far right in Italy is hoping to make electoral gains by campaigning against immigrants and portraying some as drug dealers.
If you go after someone and they flee, it's not racist. If they're escaping, it's because they have something to hide.
And experts now think that one of Saturn's many moons could have the conditions to support life. It's the eve of China's week-long New Year holiday, but instead of celebrating, many Chinese will be stuck at home as a lockdown in several cities in Hubei province has been imposed to halt the spread of a new strain of coronavirus. 26 people are now known to have died in China. There are more than 800 confirmed cases there and some outside the country as well. Disneyland in Shanghai and parts of the Great Wall of China are being closed to visitors. Dr. Takeshi Kasai is from the World Health Organization.
It is an emergency for China, but not yet for the global level. And this attempt in Wuhan and now in the several cities is actually the serious attempt to slow down the spread, the virus coming out from Wuhan, from China.
Professor Ivan Hung is the head of the Infectious Diseases Division at the University of Hong Kong. He says the travel restrictions may have come in too late.
It actually coincides with the Chinese New Year. There was a huge movement of people traveling out of Wuhan before they actually locking up the city. I think already before the ban, in fact, about, 300,000 people have left Wuhan the day before.
Tulip Mazunda is our global health correspondent. I asked her if the measures China is taking would be enough to contain the virus.
It's taken some quite big, serious steps quite early on in this outbreak. Obviously, this is a very busy time in China. It's the eve of the Lunar New Year. There have been lots of people who've been travelling to see family. I mean, this is a time where people would normally be out and about and celebrating. And Chinese authorities, particularly in Hubei and Wuhan, the capital, where this virus looks like it originated from, have really cracked down on movements. They're telling people in other cities as well, if they've come back from Wuhan recently, to stay inside for a couple of weeks to almost isolate themselves. So they are taking some very serious big steps. And the hope is, of course, that this will stem the spread. Now, we've already seen it go into several different areas of China now, including it's now in a northern province, which is close to the border with Russia. We are seeing this move quite a bit within China, which is why your guest there from the World Health Organization was saying this is an emergency in China. It's not yet seen as an international health emergency. The World Health Organization had a meeting about that and they decided against declaring an international emergency. But clearly this is extremely serious in China and a global emergency may be yet to come.
And it seems that China are taking it more seriously than outbreaks in the past because there had been concerns that there could be some kind of cover-up, hadn't there?
Yes, and that's because of how China dealt with SARS, a similar coronavirus that has similar symptoms, 20 years ago. Not enough information was shared at that time and the cover-up led to information about the virus not being known and therefore not being communicated and people moving around and spreading it. And we saw more than 800 deaths in the SARS outbreak. So as we've been hearing today, lessons have been learned. The World Health Organization says that China is being much more open about it this time around.
And I think what a lot of people want to know is how is it transmitted and how serious are the symptoms?
Exactly how it's transmitted is still being investigated. Again, we're only a few weeks into this outbreak. They only identified this brand new virus about 2 weeks ago. But scientists think that it passes between people through quite close contact, sneezing, coughing. A number of health workers have been infected because they're obviously dealing very closely with patients, family members as well. It's easy for them to become infected too. And the symptoms can range. It can be quite mild, a cough, a cold, particularly younger people, that seems to be the case. But it can lead to pneumonia, problems breathing, organ failure and death, but that tends to happen in older people, as far as we know so far, with underlying health problems.
That was Tulip Mazunda. Next. One of the biggest anti-American demonstrations in recent times has been taking place in the Iraqi capital, Baghdad. Tens of thousands of people took part in the march, organised by the cleric Muqtada al-Sadr, against the presence of US and other foreign troops in Iraq. The American military presence in the country has become increasingly controversial since the Iranian general Qasem Soleimani was killed in a US drone strike in Baghdad. Separate anti-government protests have been taking place in Iraq for the last 3 months. Our correspondent Martin Patience, who's in Baghdad, told us more about the Friday demonstration.
It was an extraordinary demonstration wrapped up before Friday prayers here in Baghdad. This was a show of force from Muqtada al-Sadr. As you mentioned, he's a prominent Shia cleric. In the past, he has fought against US forces. He's a very mercurial figure who until now had held his cards close to his chest. Well, he's come out with this march, with this show of strength, to say that he wants to see American forces leave the country. And this demonstration, I think, will pile yet more pressure on the Iraqi government, which has been paralysed by protests in recent months. And then, of course, you have Iraq caught up in the growing tensions between America and Iran, it following the assassination of the top Iranian general on Iraqi soil just a few weeks ago.
And could you see this having any kind of impact in terms of American troops leaving Iraq?
It's very difficult to know exactly what's going to happen. I think it will put yet more pressure on the Iraqi government. Ultimately, it's up for them to decide whether American troops stay or not. What is clear is that the voices calling for American troops to go are growing. And the reason for that, some would argue, is that many of the politicians in Iraq are under the influence of Iran. Iran, of course, backs many militias in Iraq as well. What you don't hear so much is there are people, Iraqis, who want American forces to stay. Some of them are in the north, the Kurds. Others are from the Sunni minority in the country. And the reason they want American forces to stay is because they believe that they will act as a brake on these Shia militias who have a huge amount of control across the country. They may dampen Iranian influence in Iraq. They don't like Iran interfering in Iraqi affairs. But also it's Americans, let's not forget, who've played a pivotal role in the fight against the Islamic State group. And the argument is, as soon as American forces pull out of Iraq, then IS could well stage a resurgence.
That was Martin Patience in Baghdad. Italy's leading right-wing politician, Matteo Salvini, is hoping to cause a political earthquake on Sunday by winning elections in Emilia-Romagna, a region that has been a left-wing stronghold since the Second World War. If his League party does secure a majority, that could result in the collapse of Italy's fragile coalition government and force national elections, which polls suggest Mr. Salvini would win. So what's driving support for the right? Our Italy correspondent Mark Lowen reports from Emilia Romagna.
Just arrived in Ferrara, a town in northern Italy that's been a bastion of the centre-left since the Second World War until last year when they voted in the far-right League Party of Matteo Salvini. And as soon as you get out of the station, the first part of the city goes a long way to explaining why. It's called GAD. It's a real problem area. Crime, migration, drug dealing. And the message of the League party here was, give us control of Ferrara and we'll make this area safe again. Beneath the area's 1970s concrete skyscraper, I meet Nicola Lodi, Ferrara's new far-right deputy mayor, a brawny, tough talker, nicknamed the Sheriff.
We had to start to liberate this area from these Nigerians who were dealing drugs here illegally. This place was packed with drug dealers. Look at those dealers there. Come and see.
Sono scappati. Eccoli.
And they've just gone into the building. Oh, Gigi, they've gone away.
non è razzista di pensare.
Isn't it racist to assume the Nigerians are drug dealers, I ask?
Se andare vicino una persona.
If you go after someone and they flee, it's not racist. If they're escaping, it's because they have something to hide.
In central Ferrara, with its sublime Renaissance castle and cathedral, Nicola Lodi is campaigning to win Sunday's regional election. That would break 75 years of left-wing control here, possibly topple the government and sweep the far-right populist Matteo Salvini into power as Prime Minister.
Posso salutarti?
Dipende, dipende chi è.
He stops off in the shop of Cristina Perdonati, where the message resonates. The migrants bring illnesses, she says. I have nothing against the people who come here, but Italians must come first.
Prima gli italiani.
Nice to meet you.
Nice meeting you.
What's your name?
Rosalind.
But for migrants like Rosalind, the new hardline council sows fear.
What's happening to Italy? What's happening to this city?
To me, I can't say. I don't know what is happening right now. Maybe they don't want the foreigners. The new party now, we're looking for reasons to close shops. So for 2 months, my shop was closed down. It makes me feel I'm intimidated. Sometimes my child used to ask me, Mommy, why is it that the police always come? I said, I don't know.
Near Ferrara, they're preparing for a Salvini rally, the square filling up. This region is one of Italy's wealthiest. Unemployment is half the national average. But an ageing population has struggled to accept migrants, and many here are frustrated with stasis and Italy's economic stagnation.
Italiani orgogliosi di essere italiani.
The rock star of Italian politics charms the crowd with his line, security, migration, change.
Non ha creato la paura.
Haven't you created a fear of the other, I ask him?
Perché Salvini gli dice tramite la BBC di...
No, if people are fearful, it's not because Salvini tells them through the BBC that they should be afraid. If crime is on the rise, it's a problem. But we don't only speak about security, we also tell people about the economy, jobs, pensions and schools.
And I ask, what about those who say the League is racist and fascist?
I'm the least racist person in the world.
Not absolutely everybody on this square supports Salvini. There are a few opponents of him over here. Let's just go and talk to them.
What it stands for, hate and discrimination, it's not what we want. We passed this thoughts 70 years ago when the war ended and where Mussolini died.
Back in Ferrara Old Town, a pianist serenades beneath the spires, a scene out of Italy's Dolce Vita. And yet this country feels politically lost, swinging between extremes in a constant identity crisis. This Sunday could be a turning point. If the far right wins here, they could win across Italy and drag Europe to a new beat.
Mark Lowen reporting. The dating app Tinder is adding new safety features following the example of cab services like Uber. Users can now access a panic button if they feel unsafe on a date. Our reporter Stephanie Prentice has more.
When a young British backpacker, Grace Mullane, went missing in New Zealand last November, the authorities tracked her movements to a Tinder date. The man she met on the app and went for drinks with later took her home and strangled her. He then went on another Tinder date while Grace's body remained on the floor of his room. In another case late last year, a woman in Omaha was murdered and dismembered after meeting a man from the app. These are some of many cases that have put pressure on Tinder to ramp up its safety features. In the latest update, some users will be able to press a panic button if they feel unsafe on a date. Third-party software Noonlight, which allows location tracking, will then send the details to the relevant authorities. This is likely to raise concerns about privacy. Location sharing apps have come under scrutiny recently for selling users' information to advertisers. But Match.com, who own Tinder, say only the external security platform will be able to access users' data. Match also want to begin vetting photos using artificial intelligence, giving blue ticks to verified profiles in a crackdown on photo fraud. The new features will begin to appear next week, starting in the US. And if they work, the group want to roll them out across their other dating products.
Stephanie Prentice. Now, here's a question for you. Does life exist elsewhere in our solar system? Well, that's the intriguing proposition being explored by Dr. Christopher Glynn of the Southwest Research Institute in San Antonio, Texas. He's been looking at Saturn's moon Enceladus using data from a NASA mission. That suggests that chemical reactions on the moon could mean there are enough energy sources to support life there.
It appears that Enceladus has the right stuff. We think that it has the key ingredients that life as we know it would need. There's the liquid water. We have the important chemical building blocks, the organic molecules, source of nitrogen, and then we also have found a source of chemical energy.
So that's all very exciting. As I understand it, though, life itself hasn't been found. I mean, is that a surprise, given that you think you found the ingredients?
No, it's not a surprise at all, because the mission, the Cassini mission, was never designed to look for signs of life, things that we call biosignatures. These are special molecules or different groups of molecules that we associate with life. And when the Cassini mission was designed, we had no idea that there was an ocean that we might think life could be in. It's not surprising at all, because the instruments actually performed wildly beyond their initial capabilities.
And so now you've got these, let's say, preliminary findings, even if based on a decade-long project. What do you think should happen next?
Well, we're doing a few things. So the first step is we're continuing to reap the rewards from Cassini. NASA archives all the data, so we're continuing to analyze the data using ever more sophisticated models. And then we're also starting to have serious discussions about designing the next mission to go to Enceladus. NASA's interested in another mission to Enceladus, and I know that people in Europe and with the European Space Agency are also interested.
And would that potentially involve getting right up to the surface, perhaps even trying to go under that layer of ice?
There's different options. It really depends on how much bang you want for your buck. If you're willing to spend huge amounts of resources, then we could conceivably imagine sending a lander to Enceladus and either scooping up some of the fresh snow that's falling out from the plume, or digging down and collecting sample, or possibly just sticking out a collector that is able to capture snowfall that's gradually accumulating. If we want to do something more on a budget, then we might do something that's sort of like Cassini Plus, where we would still be flying through the plumes, but we'd be using much more sophisticated modern instruments.
Dr. Christopher Glynn talking to my colleague James Copnell. You're listening to the Global News Podcast, the best stories, interviews and on-the-spot reporting from the BBC World Service. Every weekend, you can hear a review of the week's main news stories and why they matter. That's in The World This Week, and Max Pearson joins me now to tell me what's in the latest edition.
Well, we're going to look back at the threat posed and growing this week from the outbreak of the new coronavirus. It emerged in China, but is spreading. Also, what a week for Isabel dos Santos, known as Africa's richest woman, now facing a raft of allegations of corruption in her home country, Angola. Plus, has Libya moved at all towards peace? Post-Davos, can Europe ever work out how to tax American tech companies? And with the passing this week of Terry Jones of Monty Python fame, how far has British humour influenced the world?
Thanks, Max. And that's all in The World This Week, broadcast on Saturdays and Sundays and available to download from our website, bbc.co.uk/programmes. The United Nations is warning that huge swarms of desert locusts, which have invaded around a dozen countries on both sides of the Red Sea, could lead to an international crisis that threatens the food security of the region. Ethiopia, Kenya and Somalia are all struggling with an unprecedented and devastating number of the insects, which can devour crops and reproduce rapidly. Our senior Africa correspondent, Anne Soy, reports from northern Kenya, where locusts had not been seen for over half a century.
68-year-old Ali Bilawako is showing me how he chased desert locusts from his farm in northern Kenya. He called dozens of people to make as much noise as they could, something locusts apparently do not like. In spite of their efforts, His maize and beans were destroyed.
It's painful. We had no rain for several years. When it did finally rain last year, we were so happy. But then these insects have come and destroyed our crop. We have incurred huge losses.
Gunshots, tear gas and whistles have been used to ward off the invasion. But they don't seem to be working. Across the region, people and governments are desperate to protect plants from the locusts. Aerial spraying is going on in Kenya and Ethiopia, but with little success. There are fears the invasion could trigger serious problems here.
I'm standing about 2 meters away from where three camels are feeding. They're trying to get the leaves at the top of a tree. There's a shrub nearby. Goats and camels particularly, I'm told, like to feed on the trees. And therefore, if the locusts eat the leaves on the trees, then there's nothing left for them to eat.
Kabula Tache is a livestock officer in Moyale, northern Kenya.
What's your biggest fear?
Conflict. Once there is no food here, people will start migrating. If my grazing land had been destroyed by locusts, I will move to the next one, where I'm not wanted. So there might be a conflict, which is not good. There might be even loss of life.
Kabula and his team rely on a network of farmers and pastoralists to gather information about the movement of the swarms. We joined them on a tracking mission.
Do you think we can catch up with them?
We might, but we might reach there very late.
We have been looking for them, but we came a different route, and now we can see them in the distance. Yeah. So we're going to turn around and try and catch up with them. They are moving really fast.
20 or so minutes later, the swarm changes direction again, following the wind.
Go back there.
What's happened?
They settled just where we left. You know where we stopped? They just settled there.
I'm just trying to create a way between the bushes. Trying to get to where the locusts are. And where the locals are trying to ward them off. And looking above me, there are thousands and thousands of locusts flying. I'm trying not to say this, but the formation looks beautiful. These creatures are tiny and they look harmless. But if you consider that hundreds of millions of them are flying at the same time, the amount of destruction they cause is huge. Any moment now, they will be finding a place to rest. That will be on trees, on vegetation, where they will feed before they start flying again when the temperatures are warmer.
Anne Soy reporting. The US government is taking steps to stop pregnant women travelling to the country to give birth. Officials in American embassies around the world have been told to deny visas to pregnant women if they suspect the main reason for visiting is to gain citizen rights for their child. Our Washington correspondent, Aleem McBool, explains.
The baby is born in this country, whether it's foreign parents or American parents, they get citizenship. And there is evidence to suggest that around 7,000 to 8,000 births a year consistently sort of fit the pattern where they are born in the US, but their parents are foreign residents. So now, if officials are making an assessment about a woman who is pregnant and feel that the primary reason they're coming to the US is to give birth here, then they can deny a woman a visa.
That was Aleem McBull. It's time now for our weekly News from Elsewhere, when we talk about some of the less reported stories from around the world. In the studio with me is Martin Morgan from our BBC monitoring team, which follows foreign media in many, many languages. Now, Mexican traditional healers are sounding the alarm because younger people aren't studying herbal medicine anymore. So why is that, Martin?
Well, what we're talking about here is the traditional medicine of the Maya indigenous people, who are mainly based in the Yucatan Peninsula of eastern Mexico. They've been treating each other with these medicines made from local plants and herbs for thousands of years. But access to modern medicine means that younger Mayans see less point in taking all the time and trouble to study how to make these traditional cures. And the number of registered traditional healers, who are called Ishmem, has dropped from 130 a few years ago to about 40 now. And the really worrying thing is that only three of these people are under the age of 35. So the local health authorities in Yucatan have set up a network to help the local healers spread the word among the younger generation. What they hope is that the recent upsurge in interest amongst young Mayans in their heritage and their culture will also sort of embrace this traditional medicine. But it's actually quite a big course of learning. So you're asking people to do quite a big thing here. And it's all based at a herbalist centre in Yucatan, where they've got about 200 plants from which they make the medicines. But it also teaches them that in order to heal yourself, you also have to change your way of thinking. So it's a type of Mayan mindfulness, if you like. They have students there already from the US, Canada, even Russia. But what they really want is for young Mayans to come along so that, you know, centuries of tradition don't vanish overnight.
And you've got a story as well for us, I think, from Germany about police in Germany.
That's right, yes. It's about to get easier to join the German police force. They've been relaxing their rules on physical fitness and knowledge of the German language. Why have they done this? Well, basically, it's a shortage of recruits. They have to recruit another 2,000 officers to the federal police force this year. And so they've decided to take a bit of a softer line on the entrance exam. For example, you used to have to be able to do a certain number of push-ups and standing long jumps. Now they would rather you were able to sprint in short bursts, which, when you think about it, is actually very practical if you're trying to nab a criminal on the street.
You need to do a press-up. You're not going to do some press-ups and then try and catch the mugger. You just need to chase them first.
Well, exactly. You're not going to jump from one roof to another like Spider-Man. You just want to grab somebody on the street, don't you? Exactly. Now, the language test is a bit more contentious in Germany because they're very proud of the language, and you're expected to take down 180 words in dictation. Now, that is still the requirement. But what they've said is you can make more like grammatical mistakes, more spelling mistakes, and they'll still let you through. So they've relaxed the tolerance there. And the reason for this is that citizens of other European countries are eligible to join the German police force, and why not? And also in Germany itself, there's a larger proportion of applicants come from migrant backgrounds. And, you know, they may struggle with some of the finer points of German grammar. If you've ever studied it at school, you'll know what they mean.
I did it for 2 years and I don't remember any of it. That's really bad, isn't it? Guten Tag. How far will that get me? Tschüss.
It'll reassure a German policeman. I'm exactly sure of that. But there's also another fact, which is that younger Germans, what they call Generation Chill, they're less physically active than their elders. They lead a more sedentary lifestyle. So they're making it easier for them to get through the exam. But once you're in the police, the levels of tolerance drop immediately. You still have to get up to speed on physical fitness and everything, and they give you on-the-job training. And there's one area where there is absolutely no compromise, no tolerance.
What's that?
No physical, no sort of visible tattoos. Nothing on your face, your hands, your neck, nothing like that. And if you do have tattoos elsewhere, while you're in uniform, you have to keep them covered up.
That's really interesting, because I think in Britain they've relaxed that, because you do see police with what they call sleeve tattoos all over their arm. But for example, in Japan, I know that it's really taboo, isn't it, to have a tattoo? So really fascinating that they've still got those kind of rules in Germany.
Yeah, well, I think in Japan, tattoos are often associated with the underworld. Mm. And in Germany, they're not. But I think, you know, in Germany, you're meant to look the part.
You are indeed. Thank you very much. That was fascinating. Some stories from around the world there from Martin Morgan, who's from the BBC monitoring team. Now, police in Japan are investigating the case of a former postman who kept thousands of items of mail at his home, saying it would have been too much effort to deliver them. Michael Bristow reports.
The postman's been charged with failing to deliver just over 1,000 items of mail, but it's thought he'd actually stored around 24,000 pieces at his home since 2003. The 61-year-old has admitted that he kept the mail, saying he didn't want to appear less able to deliver than his younger colleagues. He's now been sacked and faces up to 3 years in jail. The postal service in the Japanese city of Yokohama has promised that every item of mail will finally be sent to its intended destination.
I think there'll be some full mailboxes in Japan. That was Michael Bristow. Now, I really don't want to worry you because I know there's been quite a bit of depressing news in this podcast. But unfortunately, the end of the world could be closer than ever, according to the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists. They're the people who control the symbolic doomsday clock, which has now ticked closer to midnight, the time believed to represent the end of the world. The former Irish president, Mary Robinson, unveiled the latest time on the clock.
The board of the atomic scientists decided that they wanted to move the clock in the wrong direction, nearer to midnight, by 20 seconds, which means that we are now 100 seconds from midnight, the closest to midnight we've ever been, the most shocking situation to be in. The scientists explained very clearly why. First of all, on the nuclear issue, there's been the unravelling of agreements, such as the nuclear agreement. There is not agreement with North Korea. There is an unwillingness to move forward on a very important New START extension agreement between the United States and the Russian Federation. And all of these issues have worried the scientists. On the climate issue, they point out the many reports on the science, but the lack of ability to move the curve of emissions. We're still on course for a catastrophic world. And then they talked also about the disruptive technologies, including misinformation and fake news, etc., but also cyber warfare potentially, and also the space war that's going on, preparing for attacking satellites potentially, and all of those things make the situation much more precarious. If the United States and the Russian Federation will extend this important New START agreement that prevents more nuclear weapons of various kinds, if they can extend that to 2026, that would be a good signal. And they're the kind of things that could mean that we can pull back from 100 seconds, maybe back to 2 minutes. It's still pretty grim, but at least it's not the worst. We're at the worst now, the worst moment, you know, in my long life as an elder. This is the worst moment ever.
That was Mary Robinson. And that's almost all for now. But just before we go, news that the BBC's Africa editor, Fergal Keane, has decided to step back from his role. The corporation has acknowledged the reasons behind his decision are personal, adding that he's been dealing with the effects of post-traumatic stress disorder from his decades of working in conflict zones around the world. The BBC said they were discussing a new role for him. Here's Fergal Keane reporting from South Africa just over a year ago.
Thick clouds of smoke, vivid orange flames shooting up into the air, and I can make out the figures, white and black, helping each other here. These kind of fires are usually started by accident, if somebody drops a cigarette, for example, or by farmers trying to clear their land. And so here you have black and white together fighting a fire that could destroy all of their livelihoods. A metaphor for what is possible in South Africa.
Really one of the best journalists at the BBC. The way he tells a story for the radio, it's like no one else. And we'll have more on his decision in the updated version of the Global News podcast later. That's the end of the Global News podcast. If you want to comment on this edition or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Charlotte Gallagher. Until next time, goodbye.